So here's the podcast on Derek Walcott and the two poems we're looking at from him, which are As John to Patmos, one of the very first poems he publishes. We'll talk about that as a special type of poem. And then The Sea is History, which I think encapsulates kind of what his poetic project is throughout his life, something that he alludes to in As John to Patmos. But let's begin with some of this biographical information. And we see that this guy, you know, he's Caribbean, Nobel Prize winner. He just died in 2017, the 17th of March, died at home on St. Lucia, right? He's from St. Lucia, one of the smaller Caribbean islands, pretty south in the Caribbean, right? Born in 1930 with his twin brother, Roderick. His mother was a teacher. And starts writing poetry at a pretty early age. By the time he's 18, he's writing. By the time he's 19, he's kind of self-publishing. By the time he's 20, his first play is performed. And that's really where he comes to the first kind of national and then international fame is through his plays. And this is a kind of a standard post-colonial move, right? The idea that the theater is really important for people trying to kind of break out of their colonial status. We saw Yeats doing that when we talked about the foundation of the Irish National Theater. And we're going to see Soyinka doing the same thing as our next speaker, right, as our next writer. But here with Walcott, even though we're not looking at his plays, right, he's going to do work on the, he's going to kind of make his bones and found national theater troops on a couple of different Caribbean islands. The reason why this is so important in a post-colonial perspective is because, number one, you don't need to be, right, in a place with low literacy rates, especially a place where literacy rates are kept deliberately low, usually by the colonizer. You don't need to be literate to watch a play. You just need to pay attention. You just need to watch, literally. And secondly, right, so you can disseminate information well because you're getting the people who are not quite functionally literate as well. The second reason is because the way you experience a play is fundamentally different than the way you experience any other piece of literature. I'm pretty sure that you are not having someone read this poetry or these short stories to you or Frederick Douglass to you, right? But if you did, even then, right, we experience most other genres of literature individually. They're solitary activities, reading is. But a play is necessarily a communal activity, right? You don't go to a play and you're the only person there. Even if you are the only person in the audience, there are other people on stage. So it becomes this communal experience. So it's a way to build a sense of community. For both of these reasons, that's why plays are really important for the post-colonial project. So Walcott starts out kind of as a reporter, as a playwright, founds the Trinidad Theater Workshop. All the while he's publishing poetry, he ends up getting married three different times. But yeah, three different times. I think the third time was actually a marriage, right? The woman that was with him when he died. Norlene, yeah, gets married 79 for her, right? In 1989, he becomes the first Commonwealth citizen. That means not a citizen of England, to win the Queen's Gold Medal for poetry. And in 1990, publishes his biggest work, a book-length epic poem that kind of takes all the stuff we know from the Iliad and the Odyssey and the Aeneid and puts it in the Caribbean. Because what Walcott's big project is, as we're going to see in the poems, is claiming a culture for the Caribbean that existed before the Europeans got there and exists independently of what the Europeans say culture is. And this is going to be a big fight for him throughout his life. But in fact, he's going to fight with other Caribbean writers about this. But it really is kind of his poetic endeavor from basically 1947 on. That book, Omeros, kind of thrusts him into the international spotlight. He becomes, he wins the Nobel Prize, and becomes one of the kind of the grand old men of international literature, right? He takes lots of teaching gigs at the United. He teaches creative writing in Boston, or he taught creative writing at Boston College, at Boston University, lots of places. He spends lots of time in the United States. If you read that very last little thing on the gloss, right, the Oxford Professorship of Poetry, kind of the Boylston, there are two big jobs in poetry in the world. The first is the Oxford Professor of Poetry, really kind of an honorary position for one of the great poets of the world. He was up for it and eventually resigned from consideration for it because there was a little bit of muckraking going on from his other contenders. The other job is the Boylston Professor of Rhetoric at Harvard, which is also a poetry job. The only person, you know, Harvard was founded in the 17th century, basically. The only person to hold both of those jobs at the same time is the guy we're going to cover last here, Seamus Heaney. And we'll see lots of connections between Walcott and Heaney as well. Walcott becomes this kind of guy who's championing the Caribbean. And the first time we see that is in one of his very first poems, As John to Patmos. Now, before we start reading his poetry, let me say this. He is I'm going to call him a thorny author, meaning that his grammar and sometimes it all makes grammatical sense, but it may not make logical sense to you because he's so full of these poetic devices that it becomes really difficult to understand. Right? If we take a look at that, I'll just read the first sentence in As John to Patmos, and you'll see what I mean. As John to Patmos, among the rocks and the blue live air, hounded his heart to peace, as here surrounded by the strewn silver on waves, the wood's crude hair, the rounded breasts of the milky bays, palm flocks, the green and dead leaves, the sun's brass coin on my cheek, where canoes brace the sun's strength, as John in that bleak air. So am I welcomed richer by these bluescapes, Greek there. So I shall voyage no more from home. May I speak here. And we're already halfway through the poem. And that's just the first sentence. In fact, I believe that this poem is only, maybe three sentences long. That's it. Right? But let's see what he's doing in that first sentence. John to Patmos, he's talking about John the Revelator, as he's sometimes known. Christian legend has it that John, right, disciple named John was exiled to the Greek island of Patmos, where he wrote the book of Revelation. Right? Most biblical historians date that to about 103 CE, right? So it couldn't have been John the apostle, and certainly wasn't John the Baptist either. They were both long dead by then, right? But the book of Revelation, what's it about? It's about the destruction of the old order and the creation of a new heaven and a new earth, the New Jerusalem. Walcott says, listen, John goes to this deserted island off the Greek shore in the Aegean. But me, I get this place in the Caribbean, right? John hounds his heart to peace. But me, I'm surrounded by the strewn silver on the waves. The wood's crude hair, I think probably of driftwood there. Strewn silver on the waves would be kind of the moonlight shining off the foam on the tops of waves. The rounded breasts of the milky bays. Interesting, because a bay just means a sheltered area with a beach where you can bring a boat. But if you stand up high enough, especially in the Caribbean, and for most Caribbean islands, this is true, right? The sand is very white. The water is very clear. If you stand up high enough, especially on St. Lucia, right, on one of the two big mountains on St. Lucia, and you look down at the bays, it doesn't look like they're filled with water. You see straight through to the sand. It looks like they're filled with milk. And, of course, this idea of breasts, the nurturer of children right here, right, the island itself is the life giver, right? And he talks about the green and dead leaves. And that's an interesting little phrase that he sets up this problem for us right there and doesn't resolve it until the end. Because, you know, he's a good poet, right? But he's young here, right? He's about 17 years old. And he's talking about the green and the dead. Well, if we're going to talk about the green and the dead, it doesn't really work. We talk about green and brown, which would be, or alive and dead. But he steals one term from each of those dichotomies. And it'll stick in your mind until the end of the poem here, right? He says, here, the sun's brass coin is on my cheek, right? The sun shining on my cheek. And canoes, these pirogues, right? The kind of traditional fishermen, they brace the sun's strength. They go out to fish, right? John, on Patmos, meanwhile, is in that bleak air. I've got these richer blue landscapes, seascapes, cloudscapes. Yeah, he's over in Greece, but I'm going to voyage no more from home. May I speak here? Right? Me, I'm going to write about this place, and this place is where I am. And he begins the second half with, this island is heaven. This is what John was writing about, the new heaven and the new earth, away from the dust-blown blood of cities, right? That great apocalyptic image of the dust-blown blood. See the curve of the bay. Watch the straggling flower. Pretty is the winged sound of trees, the sparse powdered sky when lit is the night. For beauty has surrounded its black children and freed them of homeless ditties. Now, beauty surrounding its black children. And think back to negritude, right? This idea that it's not just black is beautiful, but black people are the children of beauty itself. And in fact, it has freed them of homeless ditties. Ditties means a short song, right? And why would these black people be homeless and sing these homeless songs? Well, he's playing with two different ideas there, right? It doubly signifies. The first is, right, most of the blacks that are in the Caribbean right now were transplanted from Africa because of the slave trade. So they are not, or they were not at home. But now, he says, they're free of these homeless songs because this is their home now, right? They have embraced it. They have become part of this culture. In fact, they are this culture. Well, I can't say they are all this culture, but they are at least part of this culture. Who else sings homeless ditties? Well, I tell you, in the Bible, right, when the Jews are wandering in the desert, on the willows there we hung up our harps, for there our captors asked us for songs. But how could we sing the song of the Lord in a foreign land? This is one of the great psalms, right? By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat and wept because they were asked to sing songs of their homeland, but they couldn't do it because they weren't at home. Well, black people there no longer need to sing it because they are home. As John to Patmos, in each love-leaping air, O slave, soldier, worker under red trees sleeping, hear what I swear now as John did, to praise love long, the living and the brown dead. So John, right, talks about this love-leaping air, playing with the Song of Songs, and also a 19th century religious poem called The Hound of Heaven by Francis Thompson, but it's pretty obscure. He's talking about those slaves, those soldiers, those workers under the red trees that are sleeping now. Hear what I swear now. Here's what I'm going to do, to praise love long, the living and the brown dead. Now, normally, if we say we're going to do something for a long time, we say it's a lifelong commitment. But for Walcott, here in heaven, here in the Caribbean, love is life. So he's going to praise it love long. And the living and the brown dead. And remember that green and dead we saw up there in line 4? Here he's going to resolve that little problem, right? Now we've got the living and the dead, and the green, and the brown, working in what we call a chiasmus, a big X, right? How these two terms intersect one another throughout the poem. And what he says he's going to do here is, this is what I'm going to write about. These people who live here, these people who died here, these islands, this specific island, St. Lucia, this is what I'm going to write about. And because this is so early and literally published in 47, in 2012, he was still writing the exact same kind of stuff. Right? We call this an announcement poem, meaning that this is an announcement for what he's going to do. this is my poetic project. This is what my poetry is going to be about. Right? And it's brilliant for that, right? And he sticks to it because the next poem we're looking at, I think, is published in 1979. The Sea is History. And it's this great little dialogue here between a group of people, maybe Europeans, and just one guy who happens to be speaking for the Caribbean. And so we have these interlocutors, these questioners who are asking these questions, and they ask two or three questions throughout the history, throughout the rest of the poem. But most of this poem is our Caribbean natives' answers. But it starts with a question. Where are your monuments, your battles, martyrs? Where is your tribal memory? Right? And if you see your gloss in the Norton, it tells you that this is in response to this 18th century historian who says there is no culture in the Caribbean until the Europeans arrived. And what Walcott's going to say is, nah, you just got this all wrong, right? At the end of the second line of the poem, the first part of the answer begins, sirs, so you know he's talking to more than one person. It's in that gray vault, the sea. The sea has locked them up. The sea is history. And there, in four lines, is kind of a nutshell. And now he's going to show you how it is. Because when we talk about people's history, well, let's talk about Western history. Let's talk about those great stories of the Greeks, the Iliad, the Odyssey. How about the Romans, the Aeneid? How about the Hebraic tradition? Well, we got the Old Testament. How about the Christian tradition? We got the New Testament. We got the letters of Paul. We got plenty of history like that. The Caribbean, do they have a history like that? Well, here our speaker is going to tell us. First, there was the heaving oil, heavy as chaos. And then, like a light at the end of a tunnel, the lantern of a caravel, and that was Genesis. Oh, Genesis, you might recognize that as maybe the first book of that Bible. Yeah, this native knows the Bible and knows it pretty well, right? I like that idea of the heaving oil, heavy as chaos, because right in Genesis 1, we get creation ex nihilo, right? Creation out of nothing. But in Genesis 2, what we really have here is God giving order to a pre-existing sense of chaos, a far more Judaic understanding of the origins of the universe, right? This chaotic heaving oil, and then, oh, maybe it's over. That light at the end of the tunnel, except it's the lantern of a caravel. And a caravel is a ship, one of the first ships that was used in the slave trade. And that was Genesis. And that ship that was used in the slave trade, then there were the pack cries, the shit, the moaning, Exodus, taking all those Africans, or taking the Caribbean natives as well, and transporting them to the American South, or at the beginning, to Europe itself, right? That's Exodus. That's the leave-taking. Bone soldered by coral to bone, mosaics mantled by the benediction of the shark's shadow, and that benediction is a great religious term there. That was the Ark of the Covenant. You remember that from maybe Judges, or I think it's Samuel maybe may have had Judges there, or may have had the Ark of the Covenant. Then came from the plucked wires of sunlight on the seafloor the plangent harps of the Babylonian bondage. And that psalm I just quoted earlier, sing us one of the songs of Zion, right? We hung up our harps, the lyres there, they hung up. He's referring to that there. As the white cowries clustered like manacles on the drowned women, cowries, shells that were used for currency and certainly used for display or jewelry among women, both in Africa and in the New World in the Caribbean. But, you know, when those slaves were brought over here and those ships went down, they were tied up like manacles, like handcuffs, right? But he says, those were the ivory bracelets of the Song of Solomon. Another reference, biblical reference there. But the ocean kept turning blank pages looking for history. Then came the men with eyes heavy as anchors who sank without tombs, talking about how the Caribbean becomes part of kind of pirate lore or privateer lore, right? Brigands who barbecued cattle leaving their charred ribs, right? The tidal wave that swallowed Port Royal, a historical event, right? And that was Jonah, another biblical reference. And then a big question. Okay, all right, we'll give it to you. You know the Bible. Let me ask you another question. Where's your Renaissance? Whoa, you want some Renaissance imagery here? How about, Gothic architecture? Kind of obscure stuff here, right? But again, this guy's showing you what he knows. Think of Frederick Douglass, always protesting about his ignorance, but always demonstrating that he's not ignorant at all. Where's the Renaissance, sir? It's locked in them sea sands, out there past the reef's moiling shelf, where the men of war floated down. Strop on these goggles, I'll guide you there myself. Wow, look at that. Sir, you want to see our Renaissance? It's there. The sea is history, right? The reef's moiling shelf. Moiling, interesting word. It means full of turmoil and churning. Not something you'd expect your average person to use, right? Where the out to go out past the coral reef where the water's really turbulent. The men of war floated down there. Men of war is also another type of ship, right, that may have sunk there on those reefs, but also referring to the Portuguese man of war who could sting you and paralyze you, would be dangerous for you, right? And then tells them, strop on these goggles. I'll guide you there myself. And that word strop, not strap on these goggles, but deliberately bad grammar here. Strop on these goggles. Why? It's that Douglas move again. Strop on these goggles. This guy just two lines before is talking about the moiling shelf. And now he's telling you strop on, right? He used a word that might show them just how smart I am. Better make sure I make them think I'm not that smart. So strop on these goggles. And what that does also is it says, I'm not just a brain. I'm not just a guy who can spin a good story, right? I'm willing, I'm courageous enough to face this danger. No, you guys, you Europeans don't want to go out there and see that? Yeah, I didn't think so, right? But I'll go out there, right? We'll snorkel right on out there. I'll guide you there myself. Yeah, you're not going to take me up on this. It's all subtle and submarine through colonnades of coral, a collection of barrel vaults, a colonnade, right? Now we're going to get into some architectural imagery here. Past the Gothic windows, right? Another Gothic, obviously a Gothic image of cathedrals, to where the crusty grouper, onyx-eyed, blinks, weighted by its jewels like a bald queen. And there's a great reference there to Queen Elizabeth, right? Who herself had alopecia, I think it's called, where she's balding. And she, you know, onyx, she looks like this huge grouper. And he's not talking about the little grouper you can catch in fresh water. He's talking about this like 600-pound fishes that are in the ocean, right? That looks like this bald queen. It's a nice little dig at Queen Elizabeth and her she really kind of started the whole process of British colonization. And these groined caves with barnacles pitted like stone, there are cathedrals, right? The groin is also another term from architecture. He says, here are cathedrals, right? And the furnace before the hurricanes, Gomorrah, back to the biblical imagery there, Sodom and Gomorrah. Bones ground by windmills into marl and cornmeal. Marl is a collection of shells, cornmeal. And that was Lamentations. That was just Lamentations. It was not history. And then a little bit more history. Like scum on the river's drying lip, the brown reeds of villages, and at evening the midges choirs, and above them the spires lancing the side of God as his sunset, and that was the New Testament. Oh, now he's going to get into kind of more contemporary history here, right? And he's going to, it's not just Old Testament, he's going to tell you the New Testament, right? The spires lancing the sides of God, think of that. Anybody lance the sides of God before? Oh yeah, Jesus on the cross, Longinus with the spear, who does this. And then comes basically the process of colonization. The white sisters clapping to the waves' progress, and that was emancipation, right? The white sisters coming to teach, right? The nuns. And then emancipation, the release from slavery. Jubilation, oh jubilation. But that was not history, that was only faith. And then each rock broke into its own nation. And then came this, I love this, as he describes all these human political things in terms of the natural world. The Synod of Flies, right? A collection, a synod is a group of people who meet to vote on things. The secretarial heron, the bullfrog bellowing, the fireflies with bright ideas, the bats like ambassadors and mantis like police, the furred caterpillars of judges. And then in the dark ears of ferns and in the salt chuckle of rocks with their sea pools, there was the sound like a rumor without any echo. Of history really beginning. You ask me about my history, I'm telling you, history is just starting, right? Because the ocean keeps on. If you don't want to see the history that I'm pointing you to, take a look at your type of history really beginning here. But for us, it's just a mere continuation of what's been going on for thousands of years. Again, Walcott here reclaims or claims for the Caribbean a culture that is as old and as important as anything we see from the Greeks, the Romans, the Israelites, the Old Testament, the New Testament, right? The Caribbean is worthy of being considered as a world culture.